Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from around 12 to around 1 o'clock. Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, a little bit late to the studio today, a victim, I think, of the New York City subway system. But call your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And just don't worry, Nastasha should be here shortly. Have some questions already in, so let me just take care of some of those. The other John Stewart writes in, Dave, Nastasha et al., regarding Steve Jenkins from Fairway, and who does he sound like? Those of you might remember that last week the program was brought to you by Fairway. Who's the program brought to – who's doing it today?
It's S. Wallace Edwards and Son.
Oh, yeah! S. Wallace Edwards, home of one of my favorite American country hams. Now, you know, Sam Edwards, who is, I don't know, like billionth generation ham curing guy, he – you know, he and I have this one disagreement, and every time I mention him on the air and every time I see him in person, I say this. He markets his one of his excellent, at least 1 year old age, kind of, you know, not semi-ambient cured hams, meaning that they're refrigerated during the curing, the actual curing process, so that they don't spoil, but then are allowed to age ambiently, you know, for upwards of a month. Which I think are, you know, delicious. And he makes them actually with Heritage Foods, what's the word I'm looking for? Heritage breed pork. And they're delicious, but he markets those as Surreyanos, Surrey being the county in Virginia where they are, you know, kind of classic, you know, one of the classic places for American country hams. By the way, all American country hams, almost all American country hams, are fundamentally derived from the culture of Tidewater, Virginia, because it started there, and then, you know, remember, like, everything from there over, like, through Kentucky was Virginia back in the day, and most of these, you know, a lot of these families have curing roots that date back to at or prior to the American Revolution, so, I mean, there's a long history of it there. I don't know where that got started with. So, anyway, so he's calling it Surreyano, as like Serrano and Surrey, because, you know, well over a decade ago, gosh, it's got to be well over a decade ago, you know, he decided that the kind of hams that he was producing in America were not receiving their just due, and thought they were most like some of the mountain hams. Serrano just means mountain ham, you know, in Spain. And so kind of, you know, was kind of joining the idea of this American ham with kind of this quality of mountain ham that he had in Spain. And, you know, my feeling has always been American ham is an American ham, sell it as an American ham. And Sam Edwards, you know, as much as I love and respect his products, and he, you know, he's a good guy, just call it American. What do you think? Anyone? Anyone? No. Only me. But anyways, that wasn't what we were talking about. We were talking about – what were we talking about? We were talking about Steve Jenkins last week from Fairway, who was our sponsor last week. And we'd had a little discussion about like what voiceover actor he sounded like. And so the other John Stewart writes in, regarding Steve Jenkins from Fairway – and who does he sound like? To me, he sounds like Alec Baldwin, who does lots of voiceover work, which is weird because you mentioned Alec Baldwin only minutes later, and it didn't make and didn't make the connection. So perhaps you disagree. I threw audio of the two into this link. Pretty similar, but perhaps not who Dave was thinking of. And then there's a link, which maybe we can play later, with playing you know, Steve Jenkins side by side with Alec Baldwin, or maybe we can just call that up somehow. And you know what, John, you're dead on, man. That's exactly what it is. It's Alec Baldwin, but it's kind of one of those things. Voiceovers freak me out a little bit. Like, you know, I was watching this stuff, and you know, commercials come on because I have a TV now, and the kids watch it. I watch it. Come on, please. But the commercials come on. I'm like, oh my god, is that Magnum PI? Is Tom Selleck doing voiceover work? I mean, it's not like it's there's, you know. And Morgan Freeman, by the way, I don't know if any of you guys watch the Olympics. Morgan Freeman, literally, like, I think he was, like, sitting around on call waiting for people to win medals because he would congratulate them on the medal that they won, like, 10 seconds after. Or did he record every permutation of every American winning every medal? He's like, congratulations on your bronze. You know, just, anyway, whatever. Voiceovers. Amazing. So, John, you're totally right. Alec Baldwin is the call. Alec Baldwin, of course, whose voice is amazing. John also has a question. I've been bagging all of my low-temp food using your Ziploc method for years. The Food Saver vacuum never looked like it had much advantage over the Ziploc technique and doesn't really seem to pull a hard vacuum. Therefore, it never seemed useful for bagging where you want to use a vacuum to pull your marinade into a product, for example. But I just ran across the Thrifty Vac, which you can see on the YouTube. It's a Thrifty Vac, I think one word, and Vac is V-A-C. Thrifty is spelled thrifty, as in someone who is thrifty. And it's cheap. It's on the Amazon.com, and you can look. It's like $22. I'll finish the question. And it looks like this might be able to pull a harder vacuum than a Food Saver. Do you think this looks useful as a poor person's vacuum chamber, or is it not likely to pull a hard enough vacuum to be any better than the Ziploc method? Thanks, the other John Stewart. Yeah, okay, so I took a look at this device, and for those of you out there who you know haven't seen it or you know aren't on the internets right now, although how are you listening to us if you're not on the internets? What it is it's a one-way valve and a little kind of like a boxy piece of plastic and a one-way valve that you put onto a large bag, you know, Ziploc or other, and it punctures the bag, and then it comes with a little like a sucking device, almost like a larger version of a Vacuvan pulling thing. And you stick a Ziploc inside of the other bag that's almost sealed. So it's the same as the technique. The water technique, by the way, which is what I use at home because I don't have a vacuum machine at home, is I almost entirely seal a Ziploc bag. By the way, when you buy a Ziploc bag, first of all, like Glad bags work, I'll admit. But like I always buy brand name bags because off brands suck. Never get the ones that have two layers of plastic. Get the single layer. Get also the freezer ones because they're much better gas barriers than the regular ones. And never get the ones with the slidey doodles. I do not trust the sealing capability of the sliding doodles. Get the ones that have the old school just zipper, you know, the seal without the slide doodle, right? So you seal it almost all the way up. And then you just leave the very corner unsealed. You put your finger in it, lift it by that corner. It now forms a diamond, and you immerse it under the water. As you immerse underwater slowly, you kind of, you know, force the air out from around it, and presumably your product is surrounded by some form of liquid on the inside of the bag, oil, sauce, whatever. And the air, once excluded, never comes back in because the pressure of the water excludes it. And then, right as the tip of the bag goes underneath, you seal it you pinch it sealed, and it's done. And this is the way I do almost everything. It makes a fantastic seal. It doesn't create a vacuum, but it does exclude air, which is 99% of what we want to do when we're doing low temperature cooking, unless you're doing a vacuum effect. Okay. So what this thing does is it allows you to put a Ziploc inside of another bag with a one-way valve. But in other ways, it's similar. You leave a little corner of the Ziploc unpressed. You pull the vacuum. You push the seal shut while it's inside of another bag. And then you pull it out, and it's sealed. It's not really that kind of a vacuum pump that they're using. That piston vacuum pump is never going to pull a decent vacuum. Anyway, so we have a caller. I'm going to get the caller, and then I come back and talk more about this vacuum machine and kind of what I think it's good for and what it doesn't do. Anyway, caller, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Martin from Vienna calling.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Doing well. I love Vienna. I've only been to your town for a couple of days, but it seemed very nice when I was there.
Yeah, it is. Have you been to a Würstelstand? Did you the famous cheese sausage?
No. I was there for EC, the company. I was doing work with them with Rapid Infusion. And I was only there for a day and a half, not even two full days. The only thing I got to do, we had a schnitzel at the what's the name of the place that's it's a couple blocks from the Opera House. It's like famous for its schnitzel. What the heck's the name of it? Like Opfer something.
But there is the Fiegelmüller, where you get the huge ones.
Yeah, I don't think it was that.
The other one is the Plachhutte.
I have to remember. But it was good, you know, with the lemon wedge and everything. Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed the Viennese potato salad. Yeah. I did get to visit the market, that long outdoor market that you guys have. What's that called?
The Nashmark.
Yeah, Nashmark. That was really cool. And, like, there's a lot of people there selling, because I only wanted Austrian products, because why would I buy a different product when I'm in Austria, right? So I went through there searching various different kinds of cured meats and cheeses and different products, and thought it was really nice. But no, I did not get to have the cheese sausage next time. Oh, no, I did get to have – no, I didn't.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
No, we had a sausage – no, I did, because when I showed up at lunch – for the first day, I showed up and, like, had to go right to work from the airplane. And they were like, what do you want for lunch? I was like, wurst. And so they brought a bunch of one. I think one of them was cheese. It was good, but I can't recall the name because they just put it in front of me. They didn't tell me what I was eating. But there was one with cheese in it. What's the name of it? What's the name of it?
Käsekreiner.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Käsekreiner.
Yeah. Was bedeutet Kreiner?
Yeah.
What does Kreiner mean?
Well, Kreiner, it means a sausage coming from Krajn, which is in Slovenia called Kranjska Gora. So that's where the original sausage is coming from. And then the Austrian added the cheese to it and made it a Käsekreiner, so cheese Kreiner, cheese sausage.
Well, if my memory serves me, that was it was a good call, adding the Käse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, what's your question?
Yeah. But I have a question about hydrolysis, about gelatin, actually, because I'm trying to do kind of a vodka panna cotta.
Right.
And I have problems to get it, like, stiff, really. So, and I know, of course, that adding alcohol to gelatin decreases the stability of the gel you have in the end, but I just when I get it lower and the gelatin sets really nicely, you cannot taste the vodka anymore. So, and my question is about how high can I get that still, if you have like a ratio that I can still have a set gelatin with vodka.
Well, most sources that you read, usually for it's not really based in any sort of reality, right? They put the upper. It's based on kind of rules of thumb. They base the upper limit for most alcohol sensitive hydrocolloids, and most of them are, because remember it's not water, right? And the hydrocolloids require water to do their work. They usually place the upper limit for normal function somewhere in the range of 20%. Somewhere in that range.
Uh-huh, okay.
So in general, when you're using...
So, and that would be like the pure alcohol range or the vodka, like 20%?
Pure. That's like the upper limit. But like the more alcohol that you add to any system, right, the more... it depends on the hydrocolloid, too. The more hydrocolloid that you're going to have to add to get the same result. So, like, give me your recipe. How much vodka was in there as a percentage of the total?
There was about, like, I took two parts cream and one part vodka. So one-third was vodka, which would be, like, one-sixth, a bit less, so almost something like 20% alcohol, I guess, in the end. So that should be fine.
It should be fine.
Maybe I have to raise the gelatin.
Well, remember, though, cream isn't all water either, right? So you got cream, which is not all water. Although it's not, it shouldn't affect it the same way. But what percentage more than the normal gelatin did you use?
I use the kind of sheets that I would normally use, like I don't know, 6 sheets on half a liter.
Yeah. So I mean, if you haven't tried up, like, and it was too soft, right? Or did it not set at all?
Yeah.
It
was too soft, because my idea is that in the end I put a liquid shell of coffee in it. So basically, it's a reconstruction of a White Russian, and whenever I try to get the liquid shell in it, eventually it would break because it's just not brittle enough, not stiff enough.
Right. A couple of things you can do. you can up the gelatin concentration, right? I mean, that's the first obvious thing, to up the gelatin concentration.
Yeah.
By like, I wouldn't, you know, don't do anything drastic, like double it, because you don't have that much alcohol in it. So I would up it, I would up it like, maybe 25% or something like this, and see whether or not that adds enough. Were you close to getting it? Was it close to the right texture or not?
I mean, it's not bad. It is stiff. It is like a set gel, but it's just not easy to handle in like when I try to put in the liquid gel itself.
Right.
So I have like a failure of almost 50% of pieces when I cut in cubes that would fall apart.
Right.
So and that it's just not stiff enough. Maybe just to raise the gelatin would help.
Gelatin's good that way in that raising it doesn't. So like a lot of other hydrocolloids, when you raise their percentages, you get a lot of nasty kind of textural effects, and you get a lot of nasty kind of taste effects when you up them to the point where you get their like the functionality right. Whereas gelatin is pretty friendly that way. I mean, once you start getting very high percentages on any hydrocolloid, you get a lot of flavor masking because you know a lot of the water, which is delivering the like you know some of the water you know the water based section of the flavor component, is locked up in a hydrocolloid matrix. And so you tend to get very poor flavor release. And the reason why gelatin is so good and why it's used in these is not just because its texture is awesome, but because it tends to melt at mouth temperature and, you know, and thereby, you know, release and almost get like 100% flavor release. The only other ones that have kind of such excellent flavor release are ones that are used in kind of very low quantities, like gelan, right? But if you were going to switch to a different gelling medium for this, like gelan, the problem you're going to run into is you have to ensure that you're going to have to heat it to a high temperature and then get your alcohol in before it gets down at set temperature, right? Because the gelan is like a snap set. But the other problem is that at really high temperatures that you need to hydrate things like gelan, you can't get alcohol that high. Now you can get around it. I've made alcohol fluid gels all the time with both agar and with and agar might be another thing too because you can make agar. You can make agar a lot softer if you put locust bean gum in it or some a modifier like that, and you can get or kappa carrageenan LBG is the classic one that people use to do gelatin analogs, and you might be able to harden that one up more and have you'll definitely know faster because it sets a lot faster than gelatin does, and I've done plenty of agar gels at 20% alcohol, plenty. Because I used to do, as for demos, I used to do like alcoholic fluid gels, you know, all the time that were, you know, right around 20%. So I know that system works well, but I think the gelatin will probably work well for you if you just up the percentage slightly. Slightly, 20, try 20% and see whether or not you get – because what you really want is you want it to be just at the failure point, right? You want it to hold itself. You want to be able to handle it, move it around, and plate it. But you don't really want any more than that, right? And then that's what gelatin's so good at. Is its seeming delicacy when it's you know there, but then you run into the other issues if it's breaking, and then if your kitchen's hot or whatnot. I don't know how well a control you have over the temperature in the kitchen, but you know when gelatin gets close to being too soft, and then it gets warm, it's like you know you're done. You're done. You know you're never going to be able to handle the product. But I think you should be able to do it by increasing at those levels. If you were saying that you were going to do straight vodka, I'm saying well that's you know problematic, but you know I've done plenty of. Up to 15% alcohol with gelatin just by upping the gelatin, even ones that have to withstand fairly, rigorous, you know, conditions. Like I've done carbonated alcohol, regular gelatin gels up at those percentages, at least 14, because I've done, you know, pretty high alcohol wines that way, but by jacking the gelatin somewhat.
Yeah. By the way, when I would like put the cream, with gelatin and vodka and everything, like still warm into a ISI, and then spray it, like to make like whipped cream, would the gelatin hold the shape or would it?
Yeah. Well, so I mean, gelatin, By the way, also, like with cream, if you get well, like anything over about 20%, the cream's going to start being in danger of breaking. Like that's kind of like the magic place of cream cream liquors without any sort of added protecting things in it. You could protect the cream, obviously, you know, with various agents to stop it from breaking, but including gelatin. That's what the Kamique thing is made out of. But anyway, gelatin can be used as the foaming agent in an ISI with that. However, like if you want it to hold, if you want to do like a, if you want to make this recipe in an ISI and have it hold indefinitely, really dense, dense texture. What percentage cream is it to the fluid gel? I mean to the gel. Is it like you say like a third?
The full. What percentage cream?
Is it a third? You said
to the vodka. You mean or?
Yeah, no. It's like three parts, two parts vodka mix, one part cream.
Yeah. No, two parts cream and one part vodka.
Oh, yeah. Okay, no problem. So what I would do is I would lower this should be fine. Like you're down more like, you know, 15% or something like this. You should be okay just by upping the tip. But try this, right?
Yeah.
Take the vodka. I think it should work at around 1%. I'll just give you some random numbers to try. Take 500 mils of water. Do 500 mils of water and then 10 grams of – you don't have to make the full recipe. I'm just giving you numbers that are easy to remember. 500 grams of water, 10 grams of agar, cold obviously. Hydrate the agar, you know, whisk it in cold, bring it up to heat, simmer it for 2 minutes, temper in 500 mils of vodka, right? Let it set into a 1% gel. It should be fairly firm, even at that 20%. If it's not, you can try it at a slightly higher agar percentage, right? Now blend it in a blender, so now you have a vodka fluid gel. Now it's only 50% vodka, right? But instead of doing two cream to one, make it a little leaner and do one-to-one cream with that vodka stuff in an ISI. And as long as the fluid gel worked, which I'd have to test it to make sure that exactly at 20 that the agar works, that is going to be dense. So a lot of times when I'm trying to do very dense ISI foams, I do fluid gel reinforced cream bases, and they work really, really well. And in fact, you can do things that would normally curdle cream, like you can do lemon juice, and eventually it'll curdle, but because a lot of the lemon juice is locked up inside of a fluid gel, it doesn't break the cream right away, and the stuff that's foamed out lasts like a long, long, long time. But the one thing I will say is that when you're putting a fluid gel into an ISI, you remember it's a fluid gel, so when you point the ISI down, it doesn't naturally run down to the bottom of the ISI and dispense. You have every time you dispense it, you have to put your finger over the dispensing tip and flick the canister down so that you're sure that you have all the fluid gel packed against the head so that when you dispense it, it's actually there. But it's a fantastic way to do reinforced creams. And I do reinforced creams with like very high acid fruits all the time that way. And I'm pretty sure it would work with an alcohol fluid gel as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No problem. By the way,
I won ISI siphon by mentioning you.
Really?
Because they had like this thing before Christmas. They would give out like free ISI siphons. Just you have to write them why you want to use it, and I mentioned because I like the Dave Arnold's quick infusion trick, and I would like to use it, and that's how I won my ISI.
Oh, beautiful. Siphon. I just had another idea, by the way. You might be able to hydrate the agar in like milk or cream, and then put the vodka into it and dope it. And that way, you wouldn't have to have all that water. But you'd have to play around with it to make sure it would work. But I think that might also be a solution that'll stop you from having to add the extra water. But give it a shot. Try it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Have fun with the whipper.
Thank you. I will.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Now back to Stas. Stas
quick,
is
quick
like.
Break.
Oh, yeah. We'll come back with cooking issues and Nastasia Lopez.
Thank you.
brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surifarms.com.
Wow. Jack's here and Nastasha's here. It's like crazy.
The show can start now.
Oh man, you guys, you freaking guys. Although you missed, I went on a thing about the whole Suriano thing and how I feel about it. But now I can talk about the fact that I'm guessing, and I've never had this conversation, so I'm just guessing. Nastasha, do you hate the harmonica?
No, I don't.
Really?
Mm-mm.
I would think you hate it because mm-mm. you hate things that tell stories, and it's like an inherently storytelling kind of an instrument. It like, you know, kind of.
That's true.
It speaks from the soul. You're like, yeah, now I hate it.
No, I don't hate it, though.
Yeah, yeah. So how you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And Jack?
Doing well.
Yeah. So, Jack, you had a question you were going to ask us, right?
Yeah, we wanted to know your kind of thoughts on some of these new apps coming out that are catered towards restaurant eaters. Like, for instance, there's one called No Wait, right? And you can get on a restaurant waiting line at home with the app.
I love that.
Yeah?
Except for, you know, my the problem, I don't know how it works because I've never used it. As a user, I would like that. Imagine if you could just not admit. So I live like two blocks from or three blocks from Mission Chinese, right? Which is Danny Bowen's restaurant. And, you know, they don't take the reservations. And the wait's like a billion years. But, I, you know, it would be no problem for me to just sit at home, the wife and I drinking ourselves silly and then waiting for, you know, them to say, you've got 10 minutes to hightail it over here and I could hightail it over there. And, you know, so that would be a fantastic boon to someone like me. I don't know how they operate it. As a, you know, as an operator, you know, I know at the bar that a lot of times when people are on a list, they don't necessarily come back, you know. And so it's do they have some mechanism to ensure that you're going to come back?
We're interviewing them later today, so we'll find out.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that obviously is a boon to the consumer. The question is, how hard is it going to hose the restaurants that use it? Or do they have some anti-hosing mechanism in the application?
I think all apps need an anti-hosing mechanism.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, just to let you know, we have a lot of situations at the bar where, you know, we. People come in, we're like, okay, we're full because we only have seats for like 32 or whatever. We say, okay, party of, you know, five or whatever it is, you know, we'll text you when it's free. Then we text them, we put a reserve sign on the seat. Now we have five seats empty. And it's not just that there's five seats empty that we're not turning money around on, although that does hurt me deeply. The real problem is then people come in and they see the empty seats and they get pissed off that they can't get seated. You know what I mean? So it's tricky. It's a kind of a fine dance on how to do it. Bigger places, it's easier to deal with because they have more turnover. But I wonder how it works in smaller places. Like when you only have like 30 seats, you know, it's like it's hard to ride that line properly. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
But I'm interested to hear what they say. I'm interested to hear what the anti-hosing mechanism is. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got going today, Stas? Anything good? No,
absolutely not.
No,
no,
nope. Absolutely not.
Nope.
Nothing. You know what came in yesterday? What do you mean? We got the Sears All T-shirts in yesterday.
Yes, that's great.
They look good. Although Stas didn't get a chance to see them. She had to go run an errand before they showed up. Hey, like the extra large is extra large.
I'm glad because I'm nervous. We have most of our T-shirt buyers are extra larges.
You could sail a tugboat into the shirt that I picked up.
Good.
Do we have XXLs or are they just XLs?
No, just XLs.
Man, Dax, you know, Dax, so Booker and Dax, named after my kids, Booker and Dax. Dax, the small one who only wears luchador masks, although he forgot it this morning on walking the dog, I think because I kicked him out of bed because my wife was gone, so both kids had to come out with me to walk the dog this morning. And he forgot his luchador mask. It's the first time I've seen him outside of the house without a luchador mask on in months. Like, months. Weird, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether maybe he's giving up the luchador phase. I hope not, because I haven't, he hasn't had his mask yet, his custom mask. How did we get into this? What were we talking about?
Shirts.
Oh, shirts. So he was like, I want a Sears All shirt. I was like, Dax, I guarantee you we didn't order any kid sizes. Am I right?
There's only smalls. I mean, the price would have been a lot higher if we had kid sizes. So just thinking about the company.
What? See, Stas always tries to make it seem like I'm being an ogre for no reason. Like, first of all, people, I was never once consulted on this. And I would have said, you know, yeah, no, we're not going to order kid sizes because it's fundamentally not something we want kids to play with. Small is not, like, Dax is like, he's nine. He's not like, he's not like a teenager. Bed, right? Booker could wear a small. Yeah. No, Dax wants to wear it around. Mm. Dax wants to wear it, like, on the street.
In the washer, in the dryer.
Are you, now you're saying that the ones we bought are going to shrink?
No, like, there's a way to shrink them, right, in the what? Dryer. There's a way to shrink shirts on purpose, right?
I don't know. I don't do that kind of thing. I don't try to buy normal shirts and then shrink them down to club wear because I don't go to clubs. Okay. No offense. No problem with clubs. So back to John Stewart's, the other John Stewart's question. For those of you that don't remember, because it seemed like it was a long time ago, the issue is will this new thing, this thrifty vac, work to pull a real vacuum on something as opposed to just using a Ziploc? My feeling is that it's not going to suck any more hardcore of a vacuum than a vacuum van thing can suck, and that it's not – it's probably useful if you want to – without having a big water bucket around to put things in a Ziploc, but I don't think it's going to achieve much more than you can do just water dunking in a Ziploc. So there you have it. But it's cheap, and so if you want to do a lot of dry bagging work of stuff in Ziploc bags, you know, maybe it would be useful. But most of the people I looked on Amazon, it's got a lot of very positive reviews. But if you actually burrow into the reviews on Amazon, almost everyone who was familiar with the water dunk method of ziplocking was like, I don't really understand the advantages over a water dunk method on ziplocking. So I don't think it's not going to be, you know, an alternative for kind of vacuum infusion, I don't think. And by the way, a couple of the one of the people who did a review of it on YouTube that you sent us a link to said that you know, that it kind of turns it into a chamber vacuum machine, and it does not turn it into a chamber vacuum machine, because the minute you displace the air out of the bag, air from the outside pushes on top of the bag. In fact, that's kind of the MO. It's using the bag to push on the bag, and that's how it's working. Chamber vacuum machine works entirely differently in that it just removes the air, and there's no physical compression on the item until the air is allowed back in, right? So that's kind of like that is how a chamber works. This works much more in the fashion that a food saver works, except for instead of using a food saver bag, they enclose this thing in an outside bag. Now, what I do think it would be really good at probably is if you wanted to make castings, like if you wanted to do – not castings. I don't know. My brain is shot today. If you want to do like fiberglass work and you wanted to – or prepreg work with like fibers and stuff, you could because one of the problems of doing – let's say you wanted to make something out of fiberglass – and resin, right? And you want to put it over a mold. Well, the question is, how do you get it to stick nicely to the mold? And, you know, a good way to do it is using kind of a vac bag system where you put the entire you put the impregnated resin impregnated fiberglass, carbon fiber, Kevlar, whatever the hell you're using, over your mold. You put it into a vacuum machine, suck it. I think this might be a good way to do that but that doesn't come up very often in the kitchen, does it?
Mm-mm.
I mean, I used to remember the Mokume Gane thing I did back in the day with the I used vacuum bag molding for that. But that was where, you know, we took different colors of fish, layered them up with transglutaminase, and then par froze them on a mold in like a wavy shape, and then sliced it on the Hobart model, 3000 or 2000 meat slicer, so that it looked like wood grain fish. That was a fun trick. Haven't done that in a while. You know why? Because they gave me that freaking meat slicer, and I stupidly left it at the FCI because it felt it had been there so long that they kind of like, oh, stupid. I should have taken that sucker with me.
You
could
probably still take it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Like that would work. Anyway. So, didn't we have something we were going to talk about, Zaz? We had something we were going to talk about. I forget. Anyway, Joshua writes in from Switzerland regarding ice cream. Hi, Dave and Nastasha. Greetings from Switzerland. I'm a big fan of your show, and Stas is a big fan of Switzerland, as it turns out, right?
It's true.
She loves it a Swiss. She loves it a Swiss. But he doesn't say which Switzerland he's from.
Only like the Italian parts, so.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but how like cleanly divided are the different parts of Switzerland? They all hang out in like the big cities. They all hang out, right? So you get everyone in the big cities, right?
The Italians don't really move from their area.
No?
All the German and French do. Move everywhere.
They move everywhere? So, like, Geneva, there's no Italian people in Geneva?
Not a lot. Not that I saw. None.
Not one.
Yeah.
Not one Italian speaker.
They're like,
in Geneva.
They're Italians. They don't leave their mother's house.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. All right, we'll talk about that later, I guess. Greetings from Switzerland. I'm a big fan of your show. Lately, I've been obsessed with ice cream. I own an ice cream maker which is able to cool to negative 35 Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. I didn't do the calculation, but just for you, for your edification, the one I always remember, minus 20 Celsius is minus 4 Fahrenheit. So you're well into the minus range, well into the minus range, probably around minus 20 Fahrenheit, something pretty hardcore. Anyway, a couple of days ago, I made a whiskey ice cream on a recipe by Heston Blumenthal, which, by the way, I looked up the Blumenthal recipe, so that what's about to happen isn't – like whatever is about to happen, the results that Joshua had that he's not going to be happy with, he's going to describe in a minute, aren't due to a high alcohol content in the whiskey ice cream, because what I saw on the internets of Heston Blumenthal, he burns the whiskey first to get rid of a lot of the alcohol. So we're not dealing with the softness based on a high alcohol content. Let's just get that up. I don't want anyone thinking that while I'm reading this question, because that's not what's going on, right? Were you thinking that, Stas?
No.
All right. I let the ice cream maker okay, so on a recipe with Heston Blumenthal and sage ice cream with egg, sugar, and milk custard. I let the ice cream maker pre-cool to approximately negative 25 Celsius and then pour the ice cream base and let it churn. And here's the thing. Here's what should stick in your head. I let it churn for approximately 30 minutes. After that, I store the ice cream overnight in a freezer. A taste test the next morning left me unsatisfied. Though the ice cream was tasty, but it seemed that two large ice crystals had formed because it had an unpleasant mouthfeel and didn't feel smooth. Therefore, my questions. How does the churning time influence the development of ice crystals? Is there a minimum time which you would suggest? Do you see any flaws in my ice cream making, and can you recommend any good literature on ice cream making and the theoretical base? I've read the chapter on ice cream in the book, The Kitchen as a Laboratory, but need more. Thank you in advance for your help, Joshua. By the way, the word laboratory brings up – so Travis Huggett, who did the photography on my cocktail book, and I – we were in the subway the other day, and – when I say the other day, I mean yesterday. And we had, like, seriously, the idea that could make us, like the new, like, Ann Getty slash, what's his name, Wegman, the Weimaraner thing. But since we're never going to do it, I'm going to give this idea out there to somebody. Now you're going to think this is really stupid, but the more you think about it, right, the more you think about it, the better it gets. Ready? This could be the hottest wall and desk calendar of 2015. Labs in labs. We're talking Labrador retrievers in laboratory situations with lab coats on. Labs in labs. Now you're like, that's dumb, right? But look at this. I think it's dumb, even though I came up with the idea. And yet, if I saw that thing on Amazon for $15, I would own it right now. I would buy it. I would pre-order that sucker right the hell now. Labs in labs. Come on, somebody do it. Here's what I want. Travis and I, we need some cut. That's all. Like, all I want, like, maybe even a mention, a cut. You know, when they come with the barrels of money and drop them off at your house for having done this labs in lab calendar, like when you're swimming through money, just remember that as you're bailing the boat out so that you don't drown in your own money, just put one of those buckets of money, you know, our way. That's all I'm saying, right? That's all I need. Labs in labs. Here's the deal. Ice cream, ice crystals, the faster you freeze something, the smaller the ice crystals are, right? And the reason is because with rapid freezing, you get many nucleation sites, right? So ice crystals prefer to form on other ice crystals. In other words, ice crystals prefer to grow rather than to form entirely new ice crystals, right? It's more energetically favored. So the slower something freezes, the larger the ice crystals are. The more rapidly something freezes, the more different nucleation sites you get and the smaller the ice crystals are, because they don't have time to grow into larger ice crystals. So there's a direct relationship between the size of the ice crystals that are formed in a freezing process and the rate of freezing. Now, there are other factors as well, the composition of it, but for a given ice cream composition, the crystal size is directly related to the freeze time. Now, here's another thing. Typically, when you're freezing the ice cream. Remember, you're never freezing ice cream until it's a total solid. A good amount of the product of the ice cream is still in a liquid state, right? And how much of it is liquid is dependent on what the freezing point of the ice cream is, and that's dependent on things like the sugar content, and the fat content, things like this. Well, not really the fat content, but the sugar content, right? So you're looking at, there's a lot of liquid water in there. So when you draw out of a machine, you've been churning for 30 minutes, you draw out of the machine, there's still a lot of liquid in it. You already have kind of large seed crystals in there because of the long freezing time, 30 minutes. You then put it in the freezer to harden overnight, and what happens? Those crystals get bigger and bigger overnight as it gets colder and colder. So let's say you have a draw temperature. So forget what the freezing temperature forget what the minimum possible condenser temperature is in your ice cream maker, right? Forget it, because that's not what's important. What's important is what the temperature, how fast it can put the energy into the ice cream, right? So a commercial ice cream machine, even if it's only, if it's running at a higher temperature than yours, has enough ability to chill, enough chilling power that it can freeze the ice cream to its draw temperature of somewhere around, I don't know, 20 Fahrenheit, let's say, 18, what is it, between 15 and 20, I forget exactly, Fahrenheit, the draw temperature. It can do that in 10 minutes or less, right? So the LB100, which a lot of people use, the Taylor's, depending on the batch size that you put in, you can get down to like a 7-minute batch time, right? Anything below like a 7 to 10 minute freeze time, the fact that your crystals are smaller doesn't make a damn bit of difference, because you can't taste ice crystals that like your tongue can't distinguish the texture of ice crystals that are any smaller than that. So while some people say the texture of liquid nitrogen ice cream is superior to the texture of ice cream that's frozen in a regular machine because it theoretically has smaller crystals, that's horse hockey, because your tongue can't distinguish anything. But you can very easily tell the difference between an ice cream that took 30 minutes to freeze and an ice cream that only took 7 or 8 minutes to freeze. Now, the flip side is if you were to take what to do? One thing is look at the power requirements on the back of your machine, and you can kind of get an idea of how much, and you can't really, because things get much less efficient as they get colder in terms of how much they can effectively apply to the ice cream when you're making it. But almost all machines are underpowered to actually freeze the stuff in a relatively quick fashion. One thing you can do, obviously, start with extremely cold mix. Second thing you can do is use less mix. Now, the problem with using less mix is that a lot of machines, if you underfill the machine, it has too much overrun, i.e. too much air gets whipped into it. So this is something you're going to have to address or worry about. The third thing is if you are going to have a freeze time of, let's say, 20 to 30 minutes, then I would recommend only doing it right before you're about to serve it and not try to harden it. Since machines that have like a 20 to 30 minute freeze time, the texture of the ice cream is usually pretty good right out of the machine. But once hardened, then it all starts going to hell in a handbasket pretty quickly. I don't know. Does that seem to answer that part of that question? Mm-hmm. As regards references, the best online reference, and it really gets you a long way before you buy any books, is go to Google this, Dairy Education Series at the University, and I can never know how it's actually pronounced, this town, Guelph? You think it's Guelph or Guelph? Guelph, yeah, Canadian, who knows. But the professor who wrote that is H. Douglas Goff, and it's a fantastic resource, and I use it as my quick and ready resource and have for years. And it's a fantastic website with a lot of information. Now, as for books, the classic ice cream book is called, makes sense, Ice Cream. That's what it's called. And it came out in the 60s. It was released by a company called AVI Press. AVI Press in the 60s and 70s put out kind of the best food technology book series. It was so awesome. I used to go to the New York Public Library and read them constantly. And I would literally Xerox them. This is like, 20 years ago. I'd go Xerox them so I could have them, because I couldn't afford them. Now, they've been superseded somewhat, and AVI is no longer out of business. But that book was called Ice Cream by Arbuckle, and Arbuckle was it. Everyone was like, Arbuckle ice cream. In fact, they didn't even call it ice cream anymore. They just called it Arbuckle, and everyone knew that they were talking about the ice cream book. No relation to Fatty Arbuckle, the silent film star who may or may not have been wrongly accused of doing that. Whatever, I don't want to get into it. But the Arbuckle ice cream. So, you familiar with Fatty Arbuckle and silent film star stuff?
Yeah, you I think wrote he did a it? Report on it.
Really? Do you think he did it?
I need to reread it. I don't remember what I said, what I thought.
My last impression was I think he was falsely accused.
This is so off topic.
All right. So, so here's what happened. When it got bought, they did a redo of it, right, with a new author, Robert T. Marshall and W.S. Arbuckle, right? That's the fifth edition from 2000, right? Now, already they've changed the authorship on it. And then in 2003, they took Arbuckle off the book entirely, and then it was Robert Marshall, Douglas Goff, right, you know, good guy, and Richard Hartel, who's not at Guelph like Goff is. He's at Madtown. He's the ice cream scientist at University of Wisconsin in Madison. Anyways, so then Arbuckle came off. I got really pissed. I don't really like it when something's like a standard like that, and then they rewrite it, and then they just like they take the original author off. They should have called it Arbuckle's Ice Cream with the new authors on it, right? And then now they released it in 2013. They just released it as Ice Cream by H. Douglas Goff and Richard Hartel. So whatever. I don't appreciate the loss of the lineage of like such a well-known book, but there you have it. That's the ice cream book to get. The other one is called by C. Clarke. It's called The Science of Ice Cream, and it's 2004 from the Royal Society of Chemistry. A little bit of it is available on Google Books and on Amazon, and so I looked through it, and it also looks pretty good. Cover. There's two covers I saw. Cover looked like crap. It was like scooped out colored lard. Like, why do people do that when they're shooting ice cream? Just shoot real ice cream and shoot it fast, you know? Do you like lard-looking ice cream for fake? You hate that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know it. Like, you know, you're selling your science of ice cream, and then you have the other one was just a series of tubes. It's a series of tubes. I didn't get that, but I like the tube cover better. Anyway, but that's another alternative. All right. So that's good on that? Yeah?
Yeah, 4 minutes.
4 minutes?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Well, listen. So Sam wrote in about homemade pasta sheets for lasagna, and I have my thoughts on it, but I'm going to try to wait. We were going to try to get Mark Ladner on because, you know, they make the pasta for that billion-layer lasagna, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a billion layers. How many layers is it?
100.
100? So I wanted to get kind of his feelings on it, especially on, like, whole egg versus egg yolk and various things in pasta, and also his feelings on gluten-free pasta and bite and stuff like that, because he knows a lot. So maybe we can get him next week.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam, I'm going to put off your question on that till next week. And let's go up to – and I, you know, by the way, I'm sorry, Twitter folks. It doesn't look like I'm going to get a chance to any Twitter questions, but I'm going to tabulate them all. I'll try to answer some of them on Twitter, and then ones I can't answer on Twitter, I'll postpone until next week. Jeff Mays writes in, just curious if you or Dave were ever able to figure out how best to cook candle nuts so that they're safe to eat. I have a pressure cooker and a circulator and not sure if there's a foolproof way to par cook so I can keep them in the house without having to worry about them being poisonous. I called in a while ago about the question, but I haven't heard the answer yet. Okay. I've only been able to find the stupid stuff on – not stupid, whatever – but the stuff on Wikipedia that say that it contains saponin and forbol. And everyone just quotes that as a block text out of that. But I haven't found the references on relative heat stability, just that they're – just that it's inactivated by cooking, not necessarily in a pressure cooker. Typically, these guys are roasting it. So you brought it back to my attention. I haven't answered it. I'm going to – come back and do some more research on it. But you have a second question, which I can hit a little harder. For low-temperature fried chicken, if you pre-cook at 64 degrees white meat for 45 minutes, the chicken, chill, then refrigerate, what is the best fry temperature to ensure that I don't overcook the chicken but still get a delicious crispy crust? I brine using the ad hoc, you know, Keller's book recipe, then low-temp cook, chill, then refrigerate, then remove and fry. I'm using flour, buttermilk, flour procedure for frying, which is what I use, but, you know, put egg in the buttermilk. Anyway, when I last did this at 360 degrees in grapeseed oil, that's Fahrenheit, the white meat was not as juicy as when I didn't pre-cook low temp and did all the frying at 325. Or is there a different temp I should use for low temperature? I really want to do the chicken quickly so that I can have it fresh out of the fryer for guests shortly after they arrive and don't have to spend a dinner party in front of a fry station. Thanks again for the show every week. Jeff Mays. Okay, here's a couple of questions for you, or a couple of issues. So typically – what may be going on is that you're cooking it brined and then allowing it to to refrigerate and sit. And I'm wondering if it's firming up a little bit, the way that most salted meats really firm up when they're being cooked, and whether or not when you say it's not as juicy, is it there's a couple of things it could be. Is it that it's not as juicy, but it's still clearly not overcooked? Does it taste firmer, i.e. more cured? In which case, if you're going to pre-cook it a long time before, maybe omit the brining or do a lighter brine so it doesn't taste as firm or cured. I'm not sure. I'd have to test it. I don't have this problem, and I'll tell you why. I don't refrigerate my my chicken. When I'm doing low-temp chicken, I do it fairly soon before the meat is going to be served. I remove it from the Ziplocs where it's brine. I cook it in the brine, frankly, and then I pull it out, and I pull it out hot. And the reason I pull it out hot is so that the skin flashes off and gets tacky so that I get good adhesion of my batter, right? Now, I know there's a whole pies and thighs, Roberta's theory of, you know, not drying the chicken at all before you batter it, but whatever, I don't do that. And so, and then I fry it in the limit of food safety time. So I never chill it down, and I fry it at 360, right? So, you know, that's kind of how I do it. And what my feeling is that you're probably getting a lack of the feeling you're getting out of a fresh cooked chicken because it was cooked, brined and cooked. And allowed to sit in the salt, in its own salt for so long, and it's pulling on that kind of texture. But I'm not sure. I could put a call in just a couple of people and see what I'm working on, or maybe do a side-by-side test. But I would try to do it fresh, i.e., you could still do it so your dinner guests don't get hosed, right? You could do it a couple hours before they show up. But try doing it kind of a la minute, because 360 is what you should do. I wouldn't do it from cold, though, by the way. That might be another problem you're having. You might be trying to warm up the center of the chicken by doing a 360-degree cook. If you try to do that, you're going to overcook the hell out of the outside of the chicken, and you'll also burn the crust. The optimum thing is to have the chicken be, you know, somewhere, you know, like above room temperature, at or above room temperature, so that when you fry it, you're literally just focused on the crust, and everything else is secondary. Here's something you might want to do to try that as a problem is pull your stuff. If you're going to leave it in the bag and refrigerate it, try this. Pull it out of the fridge if it's not the salt problem. Pull it out of the fridge and circuit for like, you know, 25 minutes at like 50 Celsius, and then pull it out hot. Let it flash off for a little bit, or even 55 Celsius. Let it heat up, flash it off for a couple of minutes, then bread it, then fry it, and see whether that solves your problem. Maybe you're just going from too cold and spending too long in the fryer. Anyway, those are my thoughts. We got Peter Kim, who shows up late, or as last week, never. Whoa! Actually, what's interesting is he actually was here in Roberta's, but he was at the bar. But that makes sense. That makes sense. Peter Kim, what do you got for us?
Yo, man.
President,
what's up?
What are you, president, director?
Emperor.
Emperor Galactic. Of the Museum of Galactic Emperor of the Museum of Food and Drink?
Exactly.
Nice. All right, what do you got for us?
Well, I just wanted to give a shout out to the Golden Cadillac, to Don Lee, the Asian man with the best hair in New York City.
Well, and, you know, there's a T-shirt of all the various incarnations of Don Lee's hair. And I think his hair deserves the actual legal technical term of incarnation. I believe it has agency.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has a soul.
Yeah.
And I've got the calendar of his hair. And also to cocktail superstar John Darragon. The two of them put together a great event for MoFad a couple weeks ago at Golden Cadillac. And, yeah, good turnout. Dave, you were there in a mask and a cape.
Blue Diamond, yeah.
Yeah, syringes of Jello shots into people's mouths.
Don Lee's Jello shots, by the way.
Exactly.
They were Don Lee's Jello shots. I take no credit.
Yeah.
I take no blame. I was merely the barback, the server, the waitron.
Yeah, Patrick was there too, Patrick Martins. And
what was his quote? Give me Patrick Martins' quote as he self-injected himself with pina colada. What was the quote? Give it to me.
I blocked it from my
brain. Oh, come on. Don't.
Dave, I don't remember anything.
What was it?
No, it's like calling him out.
It's not calling him out. It was awesome. It's not calling him out.
Hey, how about those flat pizzas that they've got at Subway?
Don't get me started.
Don't
get me started. We don't have time to get me started.
I have a question about MSG, though.
Nope.
Oh, jeez. You know, Peter, so why don't you instead, spend the few minutes we have left, and that reminded me, now I have Cult of Personality going through my head. But for those of you that remember Living Color, the Cult of Personality song.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Good song. Anyway, so what do we got going in the museum soon?
Well, actually, so on the Golden Cadillac thing, we're going to make that a monthly thing. And so keep an eye out for that. And then we've got a debate coming up on GMOs on, I think, Sunday, April 27th at the Food Book Fair. And we've got a big MOFAD fundraiser coming up in May. And Nastassi and I are putting it together. It's going to be amazing. We've got some great chefs lined up for that. May 7th is our tentative date, but we'll be sending out a save the date as soon as we get the details hammered out.
Are we doing any particular aspect of GMOs are we going to tackle?
Man, I mean, I think one of the first questions is just going to be about defining GMOs and what those are and how they differ from conventionally grown crops, if at all.
Why is that really contentious, the actual definition?
Yeah, it is.
The definition is contentious?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will. Am I going to moderate this one?
Yeah, I will have you moderate it.
Why is the definition? Oh, I mean, how you define it legally in terms of? Hey, Stas. Stas is worried because she's got something else to do.
Hold
a second. No, it's true. It's fine. I won't discuss what it is. But the point is that the I guess the definition of what you actually count as a GMO modified food is quite important as it relates to whether or not you could sell it in Whole Foods in 5 years when they come in. Right? Is that what you mean? No one really argues about what the process of using genetic modification is. It's just whether or not a particular foodstuff is labeled as GMO-free or not, right? That's what's contentious.
That's true, yeah, and also for regulation purposes, too. Yeah.
Right, sure. All right. So, yes, a giant thanks to the Golden Cadillac, John Darragon, Don Lee, Greg Bohm, all those guys. They did a real solid service with that. And maybe we should have, occasionally we should have you come in and just give us a MOFAD update.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah? You like that?
Yeah.
All right.
And I'll stand you up.
Yeah, nice. All right. Well, that was it. Cooking Issues. Labs in Labs.
Cooking Issues! Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.